Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There is an ever-increasing awareness of those with developmental disabilities. Indeed, the Centers for Disease Control says there has been a rise in the percentage of the population, at least our awareness. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and this morning we want to explore the issues that face the children and their parents as they cope with many of the challenges that attend a special needs child. In our studio, Kelly Malone, she is the Community Outreach Coordinator of the Benedictine School on the Eastern Shore. Also, Kim Gescheidel, the Regional Director of the Eastern Shore Developmental Disabilities Administration Office. And finally, Lillian McNeil, who is a parent of a child with special needs. First of all, I want to welcome you all to the program.
Thank you.
Let's first start out, by the way, I had a question. What is a developmental disability? I mean, because it can actually range the entire gamut. Kim?
Sure. A developmental disability is a condition that is attributed to a mental or physical disability and is lifelong, and it affects all the major areas of life functioning. And for it to be a true, we have two types in Maryland. One is a true developmental disability determination, and that really requires that it was manifested before the age of 22, and that the individual really requires some significant supports in order to live successfully and work successfully or participate in life. You can also be considered to have a supports-only need, which is a lesser level of service, and just meet the first part of that definition.
So what kinds of conditions are we talking about? Are we talking about autism? Are we talking about because there's a whole range of these things.
Absolutely. And Maryland used to have more of a categorical definition really tied to intellectual disability, so that if you had an IQ of 70 or below, you qualified. And for folks who had, say, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, autism, spina bifida, a particular type of disability, you pretty much always qualified. Over the years, we really looked to a functional definition, because Maryland also had a population that we served that we called, at that point in time, the non-retarded developmentally disabled. Certainly now we've changed the language to intellectual disability, but we wanted to be sure not to lose services to those folks. So it's really based on the functional assessment. Typically folks with those kind of diagnosis will still qualify in most circumstances, but if they are really doing very well, even though they perhaps do have a categorical diagnosis of a disability, it may be that they might only need support services to be successful.
By the way, is that why, as I was reading, well, as mentioned at the opening show, the Centers for Disease Control talks about a rising percentage of the population, and I saw estimates that range, 1 or 2%, some as high as 16%. Is that a definitional issue? I mean, are we just more aware? Are we expanding it? I mean, What sense do you get about that?
I do think that the definition, I think, is a moving target. Different mm-hmm. states have different definitions. We're more in line with the federal definition. And we've used in the past percentages ranging from, for intellectual disability, 3% of any given population, to a developmental disability actually being roughly 10% mm-hmm. of any given population. I do think the growth of the folks who we now say are on the autism spectrum, I think, may be pushing those boundaries. So I do think that the percentages are varying, and it depends on the particular state you're looking to receive services in.
Right.
I wish I could give you a really good, clear answer. I'm feeling a little like a bureaucrat.
No, that's fine. Lillian McNeil, you are a parent of a child with special needs. Tell me about your experience. You have a son. How long ago was that? And when did you realize that there was something that needed to be specially done for him?
Our son Michael was born in 1966, and his developmental disability is Down syndrome. We actually knew before I left the hospital that he would, he had special needs and would need supports throughout his life. He actually was born with a severe congenital heart defect which was corrected when he was 5 and a half. So the first pretty much 5 years of his life, he spent a lot of time in hospitals. He entered the school system at 4, the education system, with a pre-kindergarten program for 4-year-olds. He spent all of his educational years in a special ed school because back then there was not inclusion. For about 2.5 years during the junior high, middle school level, he was what they call mainstreamed into the local junior high school. Unfortunately, it didn't go well. The system wasn't ready. The teachers were not prepared. The other students were not prepared. It was a self-contained class, although they were integrated into the art and music and physical education programs. But just in the hallways, I can't tell you how many times I got a phone call to come pick him up because he was disruptive or doing something only because a student had egged him on to do something. The preparation just wasn't there. The first semester, the music teacher failed him. And when I went in and said, "Why would you fail him in music?" And he said, "Well, you know, he couldn't play the drums, he couldn't do this, his coordination was off." And I kind of looked him in the eye and said, "But that's never going to change," and proceeded to explain Down syndrome and the lack of coordination and muscle control.
Was he aware of that?
No,
it was just completely out of, yeah.
Right. He said to me, "Nobody told me anything. They just put these children in the class." And it made a difference in his life. And I think as inclusion came about, in Maryland and throughout the United States, I think they do a better job now of preparing and working with the general population and the staff and the teachers, which is so great, because if you grow up with a child with a disability, you know when they reach adulthood, you know how to be a part of their lives. You know how to accept them. You know what their needs are. Whereas when Michael went to school, he was segregated. So then when he got out of school and he got his certificate of participation at age 21, and he was ready to move on to the adult programs, the adult service system in the community, people didn't know about him because they didn't grow up with him. When he got out of school, there was no program. He spent a whole year at home because there was no funding for him to move on to an adult program. They were out there, but he wasn't eligible at that time. And this is pre-transitioning youth funding, which the Maryland legislature puts in their budget each year, and we hope will continue forever.
Right.
Because it's so important that our children spend all those years being educated and then to reach that transition age of 21, and if there's nothing there, what happens? They regress. And that was my biggest concern that year. Between education and adult services, that he would regress.
Let me ask you this, and it is up to his 20s. What kind of stress or what kind of special impact does it have on you as a parent? Because there are lots of special needs, and particularly for you at that time, the environment certainly wasn't as friendly as it is now.
Exactly.
I mean, what is that like being a parent? You have to take maybe a little more care for.
Right. Well, the impact almost immediately is this is a lifetime commitment. This is not going to end. This child is not going to move on, be independent, and make his own decisions and move away. And so it's a lifetime commitment. So throughout his life, you're always wondering what's going to happen. Where is he going to wind up? What's going to happen when I'm gone? We're in the transitioning process now of going on the premise that he is going to outlive us. and that we, as my husband and I, so much want to see him in an environment, in a residential placement where he's happy, healthy, and safe before we go, so that when we go, he doesn't have multi things to adjust to deal with, in that if he's not settled in a residential program, he would have to make that change, as well as grieving the fact that we're gone. And that's a lot. That's a lot for, would be a lot for him to deal with.
Now, does he hold down a job? Is he employed? Or what's that situation like?
He is in a program. He is actually a Benedictine, mm-hmm. and he is in paid employment there. He does different jobs during the week. He mm-hmm. works in the industrial training center, where they draw on his, he has some reading abilities. They're drawing on his reading abilities, in that he's doing some quality control, checking the list and making sure everything is in the package that's supposed right. to be there. And he's just loving that. He came home the other day, last week, and said, "Some of these people don't know what they're doing." And I said, "Well, Michael, you have to be patient. You have to, you know, help them to learn, and that's part of your job with quality control." His favorite job is what's called Baker Bees. He works in the bakery. Benedictine has a storefront in Denton, which they bake for at the center, at the adult center, and they transport it over to the bakery, and he is just thrilled to death with that. He has always wanted to be a baker and work in a bakery, so he's very happy and looking forward to, at some point, someday, of living in one of the homes at Benedictine.
So, as a matter of fact, looking forward, because one of the ways that this sort of discussion, before we did the program, got into being was talking about, well, what happens, you know, when parents do pass on, and they're doing a quick calculation with you, your son is what, in his 40s now? Is
He'll
that
be
right?
47 in September.
Okay. So, and as you say, is it probably outlive you. How do you plan for that, for basically his retirement and being taken care of? I mean, what are you doing, or what's your thinking about that?
Well, our goal is for him to be in residential, yeah. Be with individuals compatible, that he has an active social life, and I know that residential programs provide that, that he's happy, healthy, and safe. He has a younger brother and a sister-in-law, and certainly when we're not here, they have certainly agreed to oversee and be involved. And they have both offered to take him in. My husband and I have always felt that Michael needs his own life. He needs his own means for happiness and social, and so does his brother. They have carved out their life, and they're entitled to that. So I think being in a residential program gives him a lot more social outlets, companionship. We all need our peers, but also being active in the community and working with all levels of people.
So you're talking about sociability and sort of getting out. I mean, obviously there's the residential area and the Benedictine, as you said, but outside of that setting, is he outgoing? Is he his involvement? Tell me. You're smiling. So for the listeners, you're smiling. So tell me a little bit about what he's doing outside of just that well-defined place we were talking about.
If you know or don't know about Down syndrome, adults and children with Down syndrome are very loving, very social, very friendly. Michael will, in the grocery store, just walk up and say, put his hand out, "Hi, my name is Michael." He is, and people gravitate towards him because he is friendly. Part of that, and that is good, but part of that has always concerned us a bit,
sure.
because he's vulnerable. He's very vulnerable. And just praying all the time that he doesn't meet the wrong person who would take advantage. He is in the process of looking for a community job through the support employment program at Benedictine. He very much wants to work out in the community, and I think that goal at some point will be met. He is an accomplished watercolor artist.
Absolutely.
And sells his paintings, donates his paintings for fundraisers. He's a very well-rounded young man. He takes care of his own personal needs. He is responsible for keeping his room and his bathroom at our house clean and tidy, and he does that job very well. And I think, having arrived at Benedictine and working in the bakery in the kitchen, I know when we had our meeting not long ago, they said he has a lot of initiative. He will go on to the next step without being told. So we're very, very proud of him.
Does he have a girlfriend?
He is in the process of looking for a girlfriend. He always has had a girlfriend. He has this need for a girlfriend. And, of course, his greatest desire in life is to get married.
Have kids?
Don't think that'll leave?
Okay.
Yeah, but having a relationship with a lady would be
a nice thing.
One of his greatest desires. Yes.
Kelly, I want to turn to you. Tell me a little bit about the Benedictine School, what it's doing, and I guess there's a new residential area that you've opened up. Tell me a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, our Benedictine Adult Services Program began in 1982 with the building of our first home in Annapolis on Generals Highway. And the adult program really grew out of our school under the leadership of Sister Jeanette. The nuns in the 50s were teaching and had a school for children and were called to start teaching children with special needs, with developmental disabilities, and began their school in 1959. So as the years grew and as the children became more and more at Benedictine, the school grew, the parents of those children really wanted their adult children to continue under the direction of the Benedictine sisters. And so Sister Jeanette, again in 1982, built our first home. Over the years, our residential program has grown, an adult vocational program with both day habilitation and vocational supported employment services has grown. We serve currently 85 adults with developmental disabilities in the region. And most recently, we're very proud of our two homes, which are therapeutic senior homes. I say therapeutic. One of our youngest individuals who will be moving into that home is in his early 30s, I believe. So again, the homes are designed for folks who require it's zero grading, for example. There's not 1 inch of molding in that house that could potentially trip somebody. It's accessible for anybody using a wheelchair or a walker. The countertops in the kitchens are at varying levels so that somebody in a wheelchair can participate in preparing meals. The homes have common shared living areas and private bedrooms with a private walk-in bathroom that's fully equipped to handle anybody of any degree of disability, along with whatever adaptive equipment they need. So we're very excited about those two homes, and they are in Denton.
So one of the things that I guess we raised this issue about the idea that you could spend a lot of effort and energy, you know, with in the early years, but then if there's not that extension of help or whatever, then you could see regression. Tell me a little bit about that concern and how, over the years, I guess, we've at least gotten programs in place, for at least some anyway, so that won't happen, either in any of you.
Well, Michael's greatest desire throughout his life, and I think for the majority of people, children and adults with disabilities, is they just want to be like everybody else. They just want to do all the things that everybody else does. And to help them reach those goals, there has to be a consistent transition, you know, from childhood to adulthood to to elderly to senior.
Lillian makes such a good point. In terms of growing services, you know, parents were really the bedrock in starting services, generally in church basements or old schools or things like that, and then looked around to see where partners needed to happen, and states became involved, and we continually look to grow services in ways that make sense. And in terms of looking at that, we look to folks receiving services and their family members and the advocates to tell us what makes sense. So they were extremely instrumental in bringing about really all of the services, but particularly transitioning youth, and making services more portable. One of the things that Michael, I think, is a good example of, it used to be when our providers received funding, it was group funding, and it was in a particular location, and it was to serve, say, 3 or 6 people. And we realized that made it really difficult going forward when somebody wanted to change. Maybe those 3 people really didn't get along together. And so then what happens? Because the funding was for the house, so the person could leave, but the funding stayed at the house.
Right.
And so that really was a problem for the person who wanted to leave. And so over the years, over the past 5 or 6 years, we've really looked at the portability. So Michael was able to make a decision to change the location of his services because they didn't suit him any longer, because we were able to divide out that funding for him, and he could take it and essentially shop at another provider that would better meet his needs, because not every provider is going to be the perfect match for someone. So, you know, we continue to struggle with the need outstripping the services that we have and the funding that we have available. And so we do also want to begin to encourage folks to look at other resources that are out there, and there are a variety of other sources that also partner in terms of services. So that we really want to be working with our school systems, with our local Department of Social Services, with our local not-for-profits, with all of the various entities that may be out there and available, because what we do know is that the traditional day and residential package is expensive. And we currently have about 22,000 folks who are in service in the state of Maryland, funded by DDA at various levels. When we become involved with someone, we're generally involved with them for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And so it is a continuing cost that grows, and we want to be sure that there's room for other folks to come in and receive services. So we're really looking at trying to get input from individuals. And at the same time, when we look to grow services, we do want to talk to individuals, and folks are telling us exactly what Lillian said. We want our own place to live. We want a job that we feel good about. We want to have friends. We want to be a part of our communities. And so we're looking for other more creative ways to do that through more use of support services and things like that, and also looking to include natural supports, people's communities. You know, you gave such a telling story about Michael in school and people not knowing about that. And we really have to do a better job to educate our communities so that, and as outgoing as Michael is, he makes friends everywhere. So, you know, I think we can do a better job at making those things happen so that it isn't a surprise when somebody gets to be an adult and all of a sudden we have to do services for them, but there are people who know him in the community and who I say, you know, I'd be willing to give him a job. I'd be willing to have him try this out here, or I'd love to have him as my neighbor. So I think that there's a lot of work yet on sort of the next transition, and we're really looking to folks and parents to help us not make mistakes in that area and to really do things that make sense and really grow that self-direction that's so critical, I think.
And rather than somebody backing off and staring because Michael looks different, they're right there with their hand out.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, obviously we've had a lot of attention, particularly, in recent years, to these folks. Certainly Sarah Palin side, the politics, certainly brought some attention
to
it. I mean, and I see a lot, and as a matter of fact, I remember that actually it was a television show with somebody who had Down syndrome. Do you think, I mean, obviously over the years people become more aware. How aware do you think people are in terms of of these folks, and has attitudes changed in general, or is it just some attitudes have changed and others haven't? I mean, what sense do you get about how people react when you're thinking about these kinds of kids and adults?
Well, I personally, I think it's changed a lot since I can remember when Michael was very young. And just going into the grocery store, people would just stand there and stare and or walk away. Or and now people will say to me or say to you, how old is your child? Or, you know, is your child? Questions that bring you together. Questions that they're truly interested and want to know, because somewhere along the line they may have encountered a neighbor or a relative. Or
if I could also jump in, I've seen a real difference in the students that are coming through the doors at Benedictine who are touring with their families. The schools are doing a great job with integration. So these are kids with disabilities whose comfort level in interfacing with people who don't have a disability in the community is much greater. And we're finding there are businesses in the community with whom we look to partner, to help employ the individuals that we support. There are many businesses whose mission is to reach out and hire people with disabilities. So when shopping at the grocery store, I noticed I see more and more people who have a disability who are working and interfacing with the public and developing what we call natural supports, which is really where we need to go. So it's very exciting. There's more work to do, but things are looking better and better.
Well, how are the schools responding? I mean, traditional schools, do you have, you know, folks with developmental disabilities attending them, or how? And what are the children in those public schools? How are they? Have they changed? I mean, what's your sense about that?
In the past couple of years, I've been able to sit in on some IEP meetings with transitional youth,
which are what are
the individual educational plan meeting. Mm-hmm. So a child with a disability is required by law to have an individual plan, and their annual meetings to look at goals. And there are professionals that work with that student and their family in the transitioning plan. And in the IEP meetings, I hear stories of the football team, the basketball team, the home ec class, really developing relationships with students, with their peers with disabilities that are extremely supportive, that are very caring, that are very inclusive, in a way that does not seem at all to really exploit the vulnerabilities that were a concern, likely Lillian, when Michael had that experience of going to the middle school. It's been wonderful to hear those stories. So I'm very hopeful that as a community, as a culture, we have become much more accepting of people with disabilities and don't see the disability as much.
Right, they're growing up together, which didn't happen when Michael was a child. They're growing up together, they're playing together, they're sharing together, and it's made a tremendous, tremendous difference.
How many, in terms of the size of the population, how many people do you think are like this are getting help, and how many are not? Mm-hmm. I mean, resources are finite.
That's an interesting. We're serving right now about 10% of the number of folks who receive services. I mentioned there are about 22,000 folks receiving services statewide from DDA, and on the shore we're serving about 2,200 folks. So that's about 10% overall of the folks who are in service, which is interesting because we only have about 7.4% of the population. In terms of trying to identify the full breadth of need, I'm not sure that I have any good metric to do that. What I do know is that we're getting more and more folks. The current waiting list for DDA services statewide is a little over 7,000. Those are for people who have been determined to be eligible and who are in either crisis resolution, crisis prevention, or current request category. That does not include folks who are on our registry for right. future need. So the need is vast, which is why I think that we're looking for some other proactive ways to support more folks. And our services have grown exponentially, even in the last 10 years. Our budget within the Developmental Disabilities Administration has gone from a little over $500 million to now just shy of $900 million in 10 years, much of that due to the involvement of Medicaid waiver and those funding. So we're trying to catch up.
Trying to get there, right. Exactly.
And the problem is that people move to Maryland because they understand we have good services.
Exactly. We've been speaking with Kelly Malone. She's the Community Outreach Coordinator for the Benedictine School on the Eastern Shore. Also, Kim Gashidle, the Regional Director, the Eastern Shore Developmental Disabilities Administration Office, and finally, Lillian McNeil, who is a parent of a special needs child. And we appreciate you coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC-14.org for full details and schedules.